Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. Hello, Caitlin.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
For those of you who don't know, I think everybody knows by now, but my wife, Caitlin, is graciously joining these introductions because it helps me sound conversational, which is hard for me to do solo. Eventually, I will be solo. It's like training wheels. Is that insulting?
Well, no.
Okay.
Anyway, do it.
Okay. So, how are we feeling today?
A little jealous.
Jealous?
A little bit jealous.
Why are you jealous?
Because I don't know. It's just the, you know, you really think David Kinch is really awesome. And I mean, I don't know. Do you think awesome?
This sounds a little weird. But our guest today is Chef David Kinch. Anybody listening to this knows who David Kinch is, right? David is the chef owner of Manresa Restaurant in Los Gatos, California. David also has the Bywater, which is his sort of tribute to New Orleans, and Manresa Bread. He's a three-star Michelin chef. He wrote an amazing book with Christine Mulkey, the Manresa Cookbook. And I like David a lot. Why, is that weird?
It's not weird. It's not weird. I think it's awesome. I just want you to think I'm as awesome. And I don't have all those restaurants.
Okay, so here's...
And I'm a horrible cook.
The story about David Kinch is, I'm not going to plug my book because I'll be doing that a lot in the new year, but I wrote a book that's coming out next year, and I needed to interview David for the book. I didn't know him. I looked him up, cold emailed him, and... From the first interaction, he was just the most gracious, kind, nice, thoughtful person. I remember when I first arrived in California for a research trip, I got a phone call from him. We had never spoken before, and he needed to reschedule our interview because he had been asked to go judge the season finale of Top Chef, and I think suddenly had to go to, I think it was Hawaii, and was... telling me that he was agonizing over the email that he was sending me. This is not the sort of consideration that you necessarily assume. I don't want to even say from chefs, from anybody at his level in any industry. You know, an email from an assistant would be the more normal thing to a stranger. The fact that he was agonizing over it, the fact that he, you know, wanted to be sure it wasn't going to be too much of a hardship for me, was amazing. And that was our first exchange. And the other thing, Caitlin, and you're being a little funny, but you have you ever met him?
That's the thing. I've also never met him.
Okay. Well, in any event, David, I'm a writer. I have a lot of friends who are chefs, which is kind of what made this show happen. But in any, not with people I've known for 20 years, because it's a different thing. But, you know, whenever I meet somebody new who is a chef, yes, we become friends. But oftentimes there is this... You know, there is this professional, not barrier, but they're always aware I'm a writer. I'm always aware they're a chef. And with David, it's just never kind of been like that. I feel like he and I just had this instant simpatico. And, you know, it's funny. Katz's Deli came up in this interview, and we ended up going to Katz's Deli after the interview. He just feels like a new friend. There's none of that professional sort of gloss over the relationship. Does that make sense?
Okay. I get it.
Anyway, so we have David Kinch here. David was in town last week for the Michelin event. He and his restaurant Manresa maintained their three stars, which I think is terrific. I think it's very well deserved. And David and the restaurant are celebrating their 15th year in business. And they've been doing a lot of great things. He took his crew over to France, and they installed themselves in three restaurants over there and worked with three very well-known restaurants. We'll get into that in the interview, so I won't get into all those details here. They also, it's probably sold out. This show is going to air on the 8th. On November 11th and 12th, Nico Romito of Reale restaurant is going to be at Manresa and collaborating with the Manresa team on a menu. David also gets into this in the interview, but we don't get into it until the second half. And so I wanted to mention it up front, but when I texted him the other day to check in, I think there were only one table available left on each of the two nights. Probably gone, but you never know. So if that sounds appealing to you, which it should, you should call Manresa. They're only taking reservations over the phone, and you should see if you can get in if you're in the San Francisco or Los Gatos area. All right? That, I think, is all I really need to say. Except that I think this is a terrific interview. Oh, I should add, we kind of broke from the normal structure of this show. We're only 8 episodes in, but the normal structure has been that we've been doing these interviews in a very chronological, biographical way. I wanted to play with that a little bit. So David and I don't go through his entire chronology. We do touch on certain things, but just to orient you, David, early in his career, cooked in New Orleans. He cooked in New York City for Barry Wine at the legendary Quilted Giraffe. We don't get into this in the interview, but he actually spent some time in Japan, and then he made his way out west to California. But we talk more about sort of what's been going on around the anniversary, the changing nature of his and his generation's relationship to France and French chefs as Americans, and there's a lot of shop talk in the first half of the episode, but I have to say, David really opens up in the back end of the interview and shares an awful lot. So I think it's a pretty moving hour we spent together, and I hope that doesn't make you any more jealous, Caitlin. But what can I tell you? I'm a big fan of David Kinch's, professionally and personally, and that's all I have to say about it. So thanks for joining me, Kate.
Always.
And here you go, everybody. My interview with Chef David Kinch, recorded last week at my office at WeWork in New York City. I hope you enjoy it. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. So, David, great to have you here.
Hi, Andrew.
At my humble abode, my humble professional abode at WeWork.
In sunny New York City.
In sunny New York City today. You were here for the full spectrum of weather.
I did. My flight was redirected to Hartford, about 50 miles from Kennedy.
You flew through the mess on Sunday.
Yeah, I came in on Sunday. I was about 5 hours late. We spent some time on the tarmac in Hartford.
Fun. So you're here for the big Michelin event.
Yes, the New York Michelin event and them announcing their partnership with Robert Parker.
So first of all, congratulations on maintaining the 3 stars.
Thank you.
Can you just tell me a little what that event is like for you to be in the midst of that company?
Well, it's exciting. I mean, we have an event in San Francisco. The event, unfortunately, was canceled this year or rescheduled.
Yeah.
Perhaps later in December because of the tragedy of the fires up in the North County.
Sure.
And they had an event scheduled literally the week of the most difficult part of the fires. But I came to New York because of the Robert Parker announcement. It's also a great excuse to come to New York and hang out with my compadres in New York, which I like to do.
I don't know how many people know this. You're so associated with California now, but you spent several of your formative cooking years in the 1980s in New York City.
Yes,
when you come back here at this point, I mean, do you kind of... do the memories flood at all?
Absolutely.
What comes to mind for you from those days?
It's amazing how forward the leapfrogging in culinary what has happened then. Back in the '80s, you know, it was Deleuze and Laws.
Yeah.
Where the restaurants that were in power in Midtown.
Yeah.
And they slowly backed off, but it's astonishing to see all the diversity and the change, and of course the rise of American cuisine.
That's
not only in California but in New York, of course, as well.
But what about the city itself? Like, you know, you were a young cook, kind of, I assume, probably running out late at night to get a beer or a nosh after work. And then is that faded into
tons of memories. You know, I lived on Avenue A in the early and mid '80s, which was you know, what now is Baby Gaps, where, you know, it was a different kind of neighborhood.
Yeah.
A little bit more gritty. A little bit.
And it
was a different town then, but it's now you still see remnants of it. It's kind of like a ghost and everything, but it's really nice to see here and wander the streets and see things that are still here. There's things that are still here, but is also there anything, all the changes.
Is there anything that's kind of a touchstone when you say stuff that's
I lived
still
half
here?
A block from Katz's for 6 years.
Okay, you know? So that's reassuring.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay. Talk to me a little bit about the whole Michelin thing. I mean, maybe we can even talk more broadly than that, but, you know, you came up at a time, I mean, first of all, until not all that long ago, we didn't have Michelin in the U.S.
No, I believe this is the 13th year for New York and 12 for San Francisco.
Something like that, yeah. When you came up, that was something that existed overseas, mm-hmm. That was very much associated with this sort of, for a lot of guys of your generation, this sort of, I don't know if unattainable is the right word, but this sort of aspirational level, right? That
yes.
you guys kind of looked at. And now here you are holding the highest possible rating in this thing that we didn't even have. What's the sort of mental experience of being in that realm at this point? Having come up when we didn't have that option.
You know, it was when the guy first came out in the United States, first in New York and then a year later in San Francisco, it was really surreal, I think, for someone of my age, generation, and if you had staged in Europe or had worked in Europe, you understood or you had a taste of the importance the guide had to a specific level of restaurant, you know, ambitious restaurants, the Grand Maison, the gastronomic restaurants.
Yes.
They took it very, very seriously. It drove a lot of business to their establishments. And then coming back and establishing a home base and starting restaurants here, and, you know, we're trying to be ambitious and everything. And then all of a sudden to hear that in a year, Michelin was going to open up a guide in New York City, and then they were planning L.A. and San Francisco the year after that, was a shockwave for everyone. And for me, it was like, that's great. Perhaps there can be some sort of sense of validation of what we're doing here in the United States, not only for myself, but for American gastronomy. But also, I would be lying to you if I didn't say there was the fear.
The fear of not.
Well, you know, how do we measure up?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's all subjective, right? I mean, even, I don't want to name names. There are people I've known in the last however many years who, you know, when the guide was first coming, they thought, oh, great, the guide's coming. But then they didn't get the stars, and they were crushed.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to describe. I mean, nobody's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guide's certainly not perfect. I think Michelin came in with the idea, and I can't speak for them, but what I gather is that they came in, they established a beachhead, but they intended to be here for a very long time, and they intended to get better and better, you know, as they don't. I mean, everybody remembers those first few years of the guards. There was a lot of head-shaking moments. There was some obvious choices, but there was also some head-shaking moments. And I think they've worked very, very hard to train inspectors, American inspectors.
Yeah.
I know in California we probably get a lot of the Asia inspectors too, because it's an easy flight to come over, that sort of thing. I think they feel that they're getting better and better. I seem to be more comprehensive. I don't think they're perfect. I think Michelin will tell you themselves they're not perfect, but they have a pretty rigorous system, even though we don't know exactly what it is.
Right.
My take is that they have a tremendous value of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Protecting their anonymity, I think they're trying to achieve an experience that an average diner is going to have. I think they work very hard to try to capture that.
Right.
And I think they value consistency. They also talk about a lot how the stars are solely what is produced on the plate.
Yeah.
And a lot of people disagree with that, and that's a big point, but they've always been very, very clear about that.
Always, yeah.
And people say, well, the service is important and the ambiance is important. There's no way that can't be a part of it. But if you really read the guide and understand the guide, you realize there is a symbol for service and ambience. It's called the couvert. It's the crossed knife and fork.
Yeah.
And that talks about the luxe and level of service and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think people miss out on that.
It is. I mean, it's an interesting theoretical question, right? It's like, to me, that piece of it is always like when they say to a jury, you know, disregard the certain comment. You know, at some point, if the service and the ambiance and everything else is so spectacular, mm-hmm. how do you not get, you know, it's funny, I've written about the Bocuse d'Or, the cooking competition, mm-hmm. a little bit, and Paul Bocuse was always adamant that you would only be really judged most, you know, 80%, I think it is, on how it tastes. But people spend that whole year of training trying to make it look
yeah.
as spectacular mm-hmm. as possible because that they want that love at first sight effect. Mm-hmm.
The cheering crowd. I mean, doing it in front of a live crowd like that yeah. and bringing something out that's spectacular,
yeah.
it goes a long way.
But can you talk to me a little about the evolution for you? I mean, for people who maybe aren't familiar with it, you came up at a time when it was not that easy to get into a French kitchen in New York City as an American, mm-hmm. Where somebody traveling overseas as an American and knocking on kitchen doors and getting jobs, mm-hmm. maybe you might get the job, but you might, you know, go in, there might be a little bit of hazing or a little bit of ribbing, just the mere fact of your nationality.
Mm-hmm.
And now to be...
We were unicorns back then.
What do you mean by that?
That's we were rare. You know, it was rare
an
to
American
see
it, in or, a French
or
kitchen.
Pretty much anyone else. You know, it's funny. What I do remember is every place I worked over there, there was always at least one Japanese cook.
That's so funny.
Which probably explains the really tremendously high quality of French cooking that you see going on in Japan.
Right. But what's that transition like for you to go from a time coming up as this generation where like you said, you were a unicorn to now really being embraced by that. You just spent some time in France, which I want to talk about in a second. Yeah. But is that something you ever would have seen coming as a young American cook 30 years ago?
No, I did not see that. I mean,
did it even seem possible?
It was possible. I mean, my goal was to be, I wanted to be the best chef I could possibly be, and mm-hmm. I wanted to have the best restaurant I could possibly have.
Yeah.
I had a vision of, you know, being an American cook with an American restaurant,
yeah.
but to be gastronomic and to be on par with what I was learning, the food that excited me, the food that challenged me.
Yeah.
So going to France, which back then was ground zero,
yeah.
you know, this before... You know, the relevance of, you know, the international relevance and awareness of, you know, Spain, Scandinavia, Japan,
right.
Peru,
yep. Yep.
Mexico,
yep.
that sort of thing.
Yep.
Now you can go anywhere and be ambitious and see many things. But back then, you know, France was where you went.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, France has occupied a very special place in my heart. I
yeah.
feel like I owe the country a great deal, things that I've learned. I had great experiences learning about food, but I also learned about rigor and discipline
yeah.
and the hierarchy of the kitchen
yeah.
and those sort of things that allow gastronomic possibilities to take place.
Mm-hmm. For you, the technical piece and what you just described, the brigade, the structure, all that, that's sort of intertwined, that's like a double helix.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you always thought about it?
Yes, very much so.
In what way? Like, how does...
I think that a lot of what we do, as in any other field, you know, organization,
yeah.
being prepared for service, which is essentially a show, is everything. You know,
yeah.
service, it can be the easiest thing in the world if you're prepared,
right.
both mentally and physically.
Yeah.
I think the next step then, of course, is having some sort of cultural idea, cultural significance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think it's one thing I'd like to see cooks learn a little bit more nowadays is the cultural significance of what happened before they became cooks.
Yeah.
So I'm not necessarily talking about my generation, but perhaps the generation before me.
Right.
You know, the Nouvelle Cuisine chefs and all
sure.
that sort of thing. Because those guys made significant contributions, not only on the plate, but, you know, how our métier, how our industry is perceived.
And treated.
Certainly in the media. Oh,
yeah.
absolutely. I
yeah.
mean, you know, I have cooks who don't know who Paul Bocuse is, and that
right.
just kind of blows my mind. I mean, isn't he the guy that has that awards thing? You know that cooking competition?
Right.
You know, but understand.
But we should say for people who don't know, Bocuse, although I think Point is actually, Fernand Point is undervalued
so.
On this front,
yeah.
but Paul Bocuse is widely credited. This goes to your point of people not remembering the generation before, right? Because
mm-hmm.
I think Point is already fading into the background.
Very
but
much so.
Bocuse, who apprenticed to Fernand Point, is widely credited as the guy who came out of the kitchen into the dining room and in front
of the cameras.
And in front of the cameras and networked internationally and helped sort of create this world that young chefs today take for granted.
Opened up cooking schools in Japan.
Yeah.
Started consultative contracts with hotels around the world.
I
don't think Bocuse was in New York, but a lot of his compères were.
A lot of them, sure.
Chappelle, Cendron.
Yeah.
Michel Girardi, I think, even had a place here. Regine's.
Yeah. Regine's. Yeah, where Larry Forgione was the chef at one point.
So, that never would have happened, I think. Or it might have would have happened, but it happened because of Paul Bocuse. I mean,
yeah.
Bocuse and Girard and all those guys, they were on the cover of Time magazine in the early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and that was groundbreaking stuff.
Yeah. But when you talk about the structure of the kitchen, to me what's fascinating is... And it's funny, Bocuse came up because there's a line that I had always heard. I had for years had heard it attributed to Alain Sayag. I think because he first said it to me. That I think there's this myth, forever, and you still hear it among people who aren't that savvy about the business, that people will refer to the chef almost as the person who's actually cooking all the food, right?
Oh, I know the quote.
and Sayag told me this story that. When he would come out of the kitchen at Le Cirque, people would say, "Who's cooking your food while you're out here?" And his answer was, "The same people who are cooking it when I'm back there." Meaning, it's a team effort. I think most people don't understand how many different stations one dish might come from before it all arrives in the window or on the pass and comes to the dining room.
That's a really undervalued
aspect, and the ability to marshal all that is the chef.
Yeah, it's I think at a certain point in time it becomes more about orchestration, ideas and orchestration.
Yeah.
But there's people in the trenches. You need to learn, but just like anything else, you need to know how to do everything that's in the kitchen. I mean,
yeah.
I think when you're a young sous chef, and you're in control of people who are on the line, you have to do those stations better than everyone else. That's
right.
How you guide them and get the best out of them.
Right.
They're not going to have respect for you if you're telling them what to do and they don't think that you know what's going on. That's why experience and hierarchy and being promoted from within is so important.
Did you take equal pleasure in both kind of aspects of like being a cook on the line, like actually, one of the worker bees of a kitchen earlier in your career, and being sort of the general, the conductor? Yeah. Are those equally?
Very much so. Great memories. Great memories. I am in love with the physical act of cooking.
Uh-huh.
I still am. Very much so. I cook for myself all the time.
Yeah.
I cook for friends at home on days off.
Yes.
I'm in love with cooking. The one regret I have is that I don't cook at the restaurant as much as I used to. Then again, things change. Physical limitations as you get older, energy levels. I mean, you have to be young and strong and focused in an ambitious restaurant to be working. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And the act of rote and repeating and doing things over and over and over again, that's when you put all those things in place to where acts become unthinking and how you go about it.
Muscle memory.
Yes, but then also certain things happen. You pick up an eggplant, you pick up an onion, and... there is a chain of thoughts that go through your mind about possibilities, what you can do, how you can do it, how fast it can be done.
Yes.
That sort of thing. And that kind of adds to your repertoire of creation and imagination.
Right.
And that's built up by the physical act of cooking every day.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as you get older, it becomes more about, for me, my day... I think about the kitchen, I think about the food, but what preoccupies me is the guest experience. I imagine, every day I'm imagining I'm a guest at the restaurant in terms of timing and the plates going out and who's going to get what and when they're going to get it.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. Our restaurant's small enough to where, obviously we use table numbers and position numbers, but we also use people's names. We talk about certainly repeat customers. We try to create... a seamless yet unique experience every time they come, but also with the consistency that brought them back to the restaurant to begin with.
Right.
So that's what I preoccupy myself. And then, of course, thinking about the guest experience, I become more enamored with
service issues,
yeah,
ambiance, the welcome, the goodbye. In short, a restaurant owner and not just a chef.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no denying that, you know, in this latter part of my career, that's very, very important.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to this in a minute. You're in the 15th year, or you're celebrating 15th
anniversary
of
Manresa,
the restaurant. And you just spent some time, I guess, do we say commemorating that in France? How do you describe that? Why don't you tell us what you were just doing over there with your team?
Yeah, and we've been celebrating our 15th anniversary all year long, yeah, with a series of events, which aren't quite finished yet. We mm-hmm. But the biggest things centered around us closing the restaurant, taking the team, and going to cook someplace else, and it ended up being France. My original idea 2 or 3 years ago when I started to think about it was to actually have to relocate the restaurant. Just take everybody, cook for a month, like a giant pop-up. But the logistics of that, certainly with the front of house staff, you know, not being all fluent in French and that sort of thing, you know, tailored things back. So I was looking for an experience that we could well manage over a 2 or 3 week period. But I also wanted to include the staff and certainly the kitchen staff. I wanted the kitchen staff to go and experience a little bit of what was so impactful in my career as a young cook. And maybe I did that for a slightly selfish reason. But for me, if they had the takeaway of having an understanding of this generation before us, I mean, I'm probably getting a little bit farther ahead. That's it's, I talked to Relais and Chateau, who Manresa is a member of Relais and Chateau. I talked to them about it, and they graciously offered to be a partner with it, and they helped out with a lot of the logistics.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And they're the ones that suggested maybe going on the road to like 3 or 4 different establishments over there. And of course, they were all Relais and Chateau properties, which was just fine by me. And it turned out that a lot of them are like these truly grand maison places. And I wanted the cooks to see these because, you know, they see on the internet and they see, you know, all these contemporary, cutting edge, vanguardist kind of places, but they don't have a lot of experience, and maybe they don't have much of a desire to learn about this group that so influenced us and put us to where we are nowadays.
Right.
And I was hoping that they would pick up on that. And I think they did. I mean, they were going into these places in the middle of the countryside, just gorgeous, you know, 70 years of creation and improvements, and just gorgeous, gorgeous places, big, huge kitchens, you know, that people don't build anymore.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And, I think they got it. I certainly felt it. It took me back to a place that, I haven't been. And, I think the cooks felt it as well. I think, what we did at Manresa, is offered a possibility to create a really great memory that maybe a lot of them, since they're so young, aren't going to be appreciative now, but I think down the road they'll realize it was a momentous occasion.
And what was the nature of the collaboration when you were over there?
The collaboration was the 15th anniversary of Manresa.
Yeah.
There were collaborative efforts at each of the restaurants. The last one, Le Petit Nice, which is in Marseille, a 3-star place. Right on the water, known for its exceptional seafood and shellfish cuisine. They were celebrating their 100th anniversary.
Oh, wow.
Third generation. And Chef Passadat, Gérald Passadat, has become a very, very close friend. And it really dovetailed nicely. Our 15th, their 100th, which is kind of like France and America.
That'll put things in perspective.
Everything in perspective.
That alone puts it in perspective.
You know,
there were
some
team.
Wines poured from 1917 at the dinner celebrating
Amazing.
The 100th. Yeah, so I think for the cooks to be exposed, you know, we work with some really great fish, you know, in California,
sure.
in Manresa.
Yeah.
But, you know, to see boats come up to outside the restaurants, you know, in the cove next door, and the cooks going down there and hauling the fish out of the boats and into the kitchen, you know, they're like, oh.
Right.
Oh, you know, this,
right.
now we understand. You know, I think they were just fascinated by the quality ingredients. Everywhere we went,
Yeah.
You know, it's they're like, my God, look at this eggplant. Look at this grouse.
Yeah.
You know, do they have to take the feathers off of everything?
Right,
you know,
right,
that, you know, it's even the eggs. You know, they were the eggs, you know, the butter, of course.
Sure.
You know, it's like my pastry chef was like, holy cow, you know, the cream and butter, I almost have to adjust recipes,
yeah,
you know, because of the fat content.
Yeah, and so rich, yeah. What, I mean, it's interesting when you, what for you do you think is the value? I'm not questioning it at all. I'm just interested to to dial in on it a little bit. But what for you, because you've said this to me before about people needing to know who came before. What for you is the value of that to a young cook?
It's an analogy I use quite a bit. Links in a chain. We're links in a chain. We are a particular link. For us to be the best cooks we can possibly be, we have to have some sort of cultural context.
Mm-hmm.
It can't just be a job that you're really, really good at.
Right.
You know, where you're trying to forge ahead and try to stay, what, relevant or contemporary or in the media. A great tool for understanding all that is to research and read about the cooks before us.
Yeah.
And we're in a golden age of restaurants now.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
You mean here in the U.S.?
I think
in general.
In general.
Yeah.
You know, the world, the explosion of the understanding of gastronomic food and the value of food. And there's a democratization of fine dining. But to understand what these guys did before us.
Yeah.
Now, it's easy to look at old videos and stuff like that and say, my God, you know, it's like we don't cook like that anymore. You know, it's like things appear sloppy or, you know, disorganized in a way that the precision that we have now ideas and the technology that we have nowadays.
Right.
But our job is to absorb what happened before, make our contribution. And then as we get older and we start mentoring people and become in positions of, management positions and where we're training other people, is to pass this information on, to pass this linked information on to this next generation. And quite frankly, our job is to do is to make them better cooks than we were.
Yeah.
If I feel that people who have worked for me are opening up restaurants and they're better cooks than me and they're going to have better restaurants, then I've succeeded. I've done my job in appreciating those links in the chain. And I wish people would understand that more. Chefs, you know, a lot revolve around the id and the ego.
Yeah. You think some people are threatened by the idea of their disciples or their people who worked for them surpassing them? Do you think that's
I can't speak for
anybody.
It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, I get satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
I get satisfaction out of it. Maybe that wouldn't be a feeling I had, you know, 15 years ago.
I mean, not to be corny, but it seems to me like it would almost be a parental type of thing.
A mentoring
feeling.
That's exactly what
mentoring.
It is. Yeah,
yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Is there a moment where you came to realize that? In other words, realize some new place you had arrived yourself, or you saw someone who had worked for you attain a certain level and you realized that this was sort of a goal?
I think there's a point in time where you fully and completely embrace the notion, the concept that you're only as good as the team you assemble around you,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just you.
I mean,
it can be your vision. It can be your ideas and your food, but, you know, execution is what it's all about.
You know,
guests come in, and not all guests are savvy chefs or bloggers or media or we cook for people who come in to have a good meal, and they're going to pay good money for it. So it's the execution, and your team carries out that execution.
Yeah.
And if they make a mistake, it's a reflection upon you as well, along with all the glory. So you embrace the team concept. You embrace collaboration. That's what goes on nowadays.
Yeah.
That's what I think. Here's a good question. How about this? What if a chef is really, really great and everybody thinks his food is fantastic and he opens up a restaurant but nobody goes?
Right.
So it goes out of business. Is he a great chef? You know, it's like if a tree falls in the forest, no one hears it kind of thing,
right.
You know, because
well,
the chefs cook for people.
Yes.
But if the restaurants aren't supported, you know, is he then in fact a great chef?
Yeah. In your hypothetical, we're making the assumption that people actually come and try it and then elect not to return.
Well, I don't know. You know, the restaurant goes out of business.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah. It is an interesting, I mean, it's it is a unique thing about what you do for, I hate to say for a living, that makes it sound so, but it is what you do for a living. But it is a unique thing that you do need a place, A, to do it, and B, you do need people to come and eat the food. It's not like painting. It's not like you can't be like Emily Dickinson up in the attic writing your poetry to be discovered later.
Yeah, or after you die.
Or after you die. I mean, it's something that requires day-to-day commerce.
Yeah.
I mean, at some level.
You build up. I mean, I still believe that the most effective marketing tool of a restaurant nowadays is word of mouth. People coming in.
You believe that still today?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a solid base, because you can be a media, you can be a media darling.
Yeah.
And then 9 months later, you're not.
Yeah.
You know, to me, I think if people, someone comes into your restaurant and has a great experience and they tell three of their friends, five of their friends.
Yeah.
You know, and you spend time over years, it builds up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened to us in Los Gatos. Los Gatos, by no means, is a media epicenter.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah. For people who don't know, you're about an hour roughly from San Francisco.
South of San Francisco, yeah. Yes. We're actually closer to San Jose than San Francisco. You know, golden age of restaurants, another thought. You know, we're in the golden age of winemaking, too. Mm-hmm. You know, really the past 30, 40 years, you know, the planet warming up, technology, the passing of information, staging all over the world, it's really difficult to make bad wine nowadays.
Yes.
The flip side is that a lot of wine tastes the same.
Yeah.
You know, there's an internationalist style of wine now. There's, you know, there's the old guard hangers-on, which is great. But, you know, I fear for our industry as well. It's the golden age of restaurants. But what's happening, I think, is that they're merging in the middle.
Yeah.
There is a style of restaurants, the 50 best style restaurants, where, you know, it's... I don't want to say they're all the same. I'm not being critical here. It's an observation that there is a media friendly style of restaurant where you then take your place or your country, you insert the cultural history and the ingredients.
Yeah.
But the style of restaurants are the same. It's a kind of almost like a Robert Parkerization taking place in the restaurant world. I mean, you know, it's small plates. It's one menu. You don't have choice. It's 20 dishes. You know, you could edit the menu by taking 8 out and it would be a better meal.
Yeah.
80% of the dishes are at room temperature and or raw. You know, there's actually no synthesis of application of heat and controlling evaporation of water, which is what cooking is.
Yeah.
Taking place, sometimes it feels like you're eating mise en place.
Right.
And, you know, this is, don't get me wrong, I'm not being critical of these restaurants.
No.
But to me, there is a homogenization going on.
Yes.
And I think we have to be really aware about that. So the restaurants I like to go to, the restaurants that excite me, are the ones that break that mold, that exhibit a uniqueness, a sense of vision, and are not afraid to stand up to that. It's kind of like the Rumier or Chateau Reyes of restaurants, you know, that don't back down from their terroir, the product that they work with, and are unafraid to express their vision regardless of what is considered the norm.
Well, this, you know...
That's the flip side of the golden age, the quote-unquote golden age of restaurants.
Well, I also feel like this is the thing, and I first heard this point made actually by Jeremiah Towers, the first person I ever heard make this point several years ago, but, you know, and it is easy to start sounding old when you talk about this as a factor.
I'm going to be accused of being old with that comment.
But no, but I think social media is a big piece of this, and it used to be, and it wasn't, relatively speaking, it wasn't all that long ago, that if you wanted to taste a certain person's food or even see it, you had to go there.
Yeah.
And now dishes, plating techniques, just visual style, you know, they're literally in everyone's palm of everyone's hand instantaneously. And I think the flip side, homogenization is the word that I always use. The unavoidable byproduct of that is going to be a certain blurring of lines between different people's styles and an immediate influence that used to take generations to happen.
Yeah, supreme presentation and the act of creativity have become supreme values.
Yeah.
And I think if that supersedes the taste on the plate, then it's a mistake.
Yeah. But it is, you know, it's funny. I have running debates with certain friends of mine, most of them chefs. And I do feel like, having said what I just said, you do need to accept things do just change. I mean, this is the time we're in. This is how it is. We'll all be okay. It's just how it is. I think you can't fight it. It's not going to not be a factor, right?
No, it's not going to be a factor.
You mean it's not going to come out as a factor?
No, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. Yeah. Yes, yes.
It'll always be. This is now a factor that's here to stay.
But, you know, things come and go.
Yeah.
I hope the homogenization, you know, it's funny. It's, you know, after all these years, you know, if I go into a new restaurant, especially, you know, a media darling or a restaurant that's really trending hard in social media or whatever, I go in and, you know, it can be a great experience and I could have a lovely time and the food could be great. But I can walk in and just by looking at the menu, you know, I know where they staged. I know the cookbook's on their shelves.
Right, right.
You know, I know their stage career.
Yeah.
No,
I always used to say, show me someone's like menu and I can tell you who they worked for. Yeah. And sure. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, I want to say staging, you know, we used to stage by writing letters and hope you get a response.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now you don't need to. You don't need to taste anything. You just, you know, go online.
Right.
Anything and everything you need is there, you know, in this superficial visual fashion.
Yeah.
Along with all cap and exclamation point opinions.
Yeah.
And it's hard to deny that this is influential to younger minds.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the first
level of a cook is imitation.
Yeah.
You imitate.
I mean, the other thing to me that's always been interesting is this notion of, I mean, you know, a lot of people of your generation, because cooking was considered sort of a blue-collar career because parents weren't necessarily so enamored of the idea of their kids going into kitchens. It was a new thing to do. I think a lot of people started off doing something else. I think a lot of people started off with other interests, and then cooking happened. It was almost like a second life or a second career. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, it reminds me of when I was a kid, I picked Columbia University as my college, and one of the reasons was they had a 5-year MFA program, Master of Fine Arts program, where you could get your Bachelor of Arts, for me that was English Literature, and a film degree in 5 years instead of 6 years, right? You cut 1 year off the grad school part. And I remember going to the head of the film school when I was a freshman and saying, what do you want to see when I apply in a year to the film program? And he said, I'll tell you what I don't want to see. I don't want to see a bunch of film classes. Because what are you going to make movies about? I thought it was, he goes, I want to see that you went to Alaska in the summer and, you know, took train, you know, hopped and got around on trains and lived in the wilderness. Or I want to see that you went and backpacked around Europe. Or I want to see that you did X, Y, or Z. And I feel like that same notion applies. It's not as directly.
It's knowledge with gravitas.
It's knowledge with gravitas. But also, cooking is at some level storytelling.
Absolutely.
And I've always felt like it's, on the one hand, it's amazing that you can turn on a show like MasterChef Junior now and see a bunch of kids who probably could have worked in some of the kitchens that you worked in the 80s, literally, like 10, 12-year-olds who have that level of technique, but they don't have anything else, a lot of them. And I think that, to me, is sort of the downside of people getting attracted to the kitchen so young these days.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it certainly does. I've always wondered how someone who can be successful, secure financially, and somehow feel that a second career in our industry in the kitchen, what is it that they see that is appealing? Or because to me it's for all the wrong reasons. You know, are they envisioning that can be happy cooks and happy customers, and everybody's happy, it's hard. Yeah. I mean, it's hard if you're in it from the beginning, but to come in as a second career, it's daunting.
Yeah,
I don't understand the attraction because we work hard. It's hard work, and there's a lot of non-fun moments, in a young career, but that contributes. It contributes to the overall experience.
I mean, I don't know. Most people I know who end up doing what you're doing, literally, I don't think they want to do anything. I mean, I think it's almost like when people tell you they wanted to be actors or they wanted, like, there's no choice.
It could be like me and don't know how to do anything else.
Okay. Well, that's a modest proposition. Yeah. Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
We are speaking with Chef David Kinch, of course, of Manresa. And we should say also of the Bywater.
Yeah, the Bywater, Manresa bread.
Yes, we should not leave those out. A chef from California talking with us here in New York City. And before we go to break, as always, I want to remind everybody, you can subscribe to the show on Stitcher or iTunes or wherever you subscribe. And David, I think it'd be nice if people reviewed the show on iTunes.
Oh, that'd be great.
That'd be nice, right?
Yeah, of course.
If you do that, it helps people find us. And you can also, you don't even have to write anything. You can just give us a rating. They have five stars. Just like an Uber ride, and it'll take you 2 seconds, and it'll help people find the show. So please do that if you can, and we'll be right back with Chef David Kinch. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we are back speaking with Chef David Kinch. So, David, this 15th anniversary celebration that you were in the midst of, what else has happened? You have some things going on, and you have something coming up in California.
Yeah, in November 11th and 12th, have a chef who I greatly admire, a unique vision, sense of place, a gentleman named Nico Romito. He has a restaurant called Reale, Ristorante Reale, a small cooking school, beautiful little hotel in Castel di Sangro in the Abruzzo.
Yes.
I've been enamored with his cooking for a while. I had the opportunity to eat there earlier this year and just essentially had my socks blown off.
Yeah.
How good it was. Simple, profound, deep flavors, thought-provoking.
Do you veer towards simplicity yourself as a diner?
I think the older I get, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate simplicity. There's no place to hide in simplicity.
Right.
And so he's going to be coming over for 2 days, cooking two dinners with us, a collaborative dinner. He's doing a series of courses. We've created a series of courses to go to, and I'm really excited about the menu.
Yeah.
It's just going to be really fantastic. I'm just thrilled that he's going to be here.
Yeah. There's so much of this goes on these days, these collaborative dinners. What's the, beyond the fact that it's a nice thing to do, and there's the social piece of it, and it's always amazing to work with somebody you admire. I mean, even as a writer, I've had that experience, either being part of some kind of joint, you know, anthology type situation, or working, even, you know, when I'm writing with a chef who I admire, that adds something to it. But what's the value of doing these things for you guys? And again, I'm not questioning it, but I'd love to hear you just speak.
I think it makes us a better restaurant. The team, the young cooks, the service members, they see different systems.
Yeah.
They see different food, different systems, different approaches
Yes.
that yield real quality efforts.
Yes.
And it expands their mind. It expands mine. We've done these events in the past, and we've learned things that we've incorporated in.
Yeah.
It might be the way we run a ticket, or a way a sauce is finished, or you know, resting time of a particular piece of meat that we never considered, that sort of thing. You know, these the trucs, you know, the
so
little
things.
So you
have these little aha moments when these other people come into your kitchen and are sort of plying their trade and doing
and
similar things to what you do, but doing it in the way that they're... own evolution and their own craft has brought them to
as well.
Yeah,
and I would like to think that perhaps they have the same encounter coming over. I mean, it's daunting to go halfway around the world into a kitchen you've never been, work with products. I mean, you order product, but you know, you don't know. I mean, Chef Nico's cuisine is one based upon really humble and simple ingredients.
Yeah.
He bases whole dishes just around cabbage or a tomato or a potato or an onion. And that's daunting because we have to find that tomato, eggplant, and onion. The good news is we're in California, so we got a bit of a head start.
What's the planning for something like that? How's that work? But, you know, in other words, obviously, Nico's not over here. I assume this is happening by email or by phone.
It happens by email. The first thing I do, I try to think of myself as a gracious host. So I say, send me a list of dishes that you want to do. I don't say, send some dishes that you want to do, but you can't use eggplant or pigeon because I'm going to use those.
Right. So they get the opening salvo.
We want them to feel comfortable. We want them to feel comfortable. We give them every opportunity to succeed and feel that it's going to be a positive experience.
Yeah.
And then what we try to do, because we're the home team,
we
try to fill in the gaps. We try to fill in the slots. You know, if they do a fish, we'll do a shellfish. If they do lamb, we're going to do a white meat. You know, in a very general sense, that's how we think about it. You know, so I essentially ask from him four savory dishes and a dessert. We're going to do four savories and a dessert plus some snacks, you know, at the beginning. And we make it work. And then I put it together. I suggest some, you know, I send out a rough draft of the menu. Around this point in time, I ask them for wine styles or wine recommendations for their courses.
Yeah.
And then I work with our team in placing it, so they're placing the orders, taking into consideration the wine styles, working with the somm.
Yeah.
And then I send it back to them and I say, is this a go or not? That sort of thing. And this, it's worked out really seamlessly well.
Yeah.
I'm just thrilled with the dishes. You know, I had a couple of dishes that he did and just, you know, just very excited.
Is there anything would you mention or you want to, is this, you want to keep this under wraps till people are sitting there having it put in front of them? Which is fine.
Yeah, I'm going to do that.
Okay.
You know,
that's fine.
But he does, there's this lentil dish with hazelnuts,
nice.
You know, and it's essentially just hazelnuts and lentils, but what he does with it, it's still astonishing. It still blows my mind with what he does with it. And he's going to do the dish.
That's great.
Actually requested that. I said, can you do the lentil dish?
You know, that's great. So, I'm sure he was flattered. I would imagine even the act of having the challenge of creating this joint menu is something that's great. I mean,
it's a lot of fun.
It's not a traumatic event, but it does shake up the routine, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
we keeps you guys on your toes. We created all new dishes for the menu.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
So you're not drawing on your repertoire?
No. That's a challenge for it.
I mean, great.
In filling the slots, we talked about it. And actually, we're doing one dish that kind of mimics one of his plating styles.
Okay.
You know, but it's a dish completely unrelated to his repertoire.
Yes.
But I think he's going to recognize a certain thing that we do.
Okay.
But it's certainly an homage to him.
And he doesn't know this
being
is coming
our guest.
Yet.
Oh, no.
Okay. 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 Well, hopefully
I hope he's flattered.
Hopefully he's not a subscriber to the show yet.
I hope he's flattered.
So this is a bit of a non sequitur, but we were talking when I met you downstairs before we did the interview we were congratulating ourselves on not looking too horribly out of shape.
And for all you listeners out there, Andrew's looking pretty sweet. He's a tennis playing exercising maniac.
All right. Well, how do you keep yourself? I mean, you're obviously someone who you get a fair amount of exercise. I know you're known to surf. Mm-hmm. That's a thing for you, right?
Yeah, but, you know, just, you know, the older I've got, the more I realize, you know, the better I feel and the more productive I am,
yeah.
the better I take care of myself. And yeah. by no means am I perfect in that aspect, yeah. but I'm much more aware of you know, the future that I have for myself
yeah.
is going to be better in the better health I'm in. So yeah. I'm trying my best to make an effort in an industry where it can really chomp at you physically.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to try and be a couple steps ahead.
When did you, we can say you're in your 50s. That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm 56.
You're 56. Yeah, okay. So I'm 50 this year. And for me, that was a big moment for me in my life where I kind of felt like it was put up or shut up time in terms of getting in some, you know, taking care of myself on a different way than I ever had before. Mm-hmm. But for you, you know, the kitchen, I feel like this is all of a sudden an evolution that a lot of people in your industry are starting to come to. I mean, there was that piece in the New York Times a year or two ago with Mark Peel doing his, you know, knee bends and stuff. Yeah. There's all these people who are all this, you know, James Kent, who used to be at the Nomad, who's younger by far than either of us, has become like a marathon runner. I mean, there are always these kind of outliers, but I do feel like they're part of the sort of, I mean, you talked earlier about people becoming better cooks. I feel like people are, you know, as much as maybe they still enjoy certain aspects of the business, you know, the late nights and the after hours fun and blowing off steam and all that stuff, there does seem to be a heightened awareness of taking care of yourself.
Yeah,
and what this business, I mean, the number of chefs I know who have shoulder problems,
lower back.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of friends I have had shoulder surgeries. This is something that rarely gets.
And it's always the knife
about.
Shoulder. It's always the knife shoulder.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
But is this something you've taken noted? I mean, do you feel like
very much so? It's an awareness that that the older you get, you have to train for the job. You literally have to physically train for the job. I mean, you know, you count the steps. You have to count the steps that I when I walk in the door of the restaurant until I leave the restaurant, you know. 4.5 to 5 miles a day of just stop, start, walk, turn, spin.
Is that true?
Oh yeah.
You figure this out with the aid of a Fitbit or something like that?
Yeah.
That's a lot of distance.
It's a lot of distance and you know, with no rest.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying that to make it sound like I'm an elite athlete, but you know, it's, you know, they talk about how sitting down at your job can kill you, and people also talk about standing up at your job can kill you. It's a lose-lose situation.
Yeah.
So I think the key is to be active and moving.
Yeah.
It's important. The, you know, there is, you know, a lot of the generation of my mentors, you know, they worked themselves to death. They worked and they died in the kitchen, or they worked until, you know, their knees gave out.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, people didn't take care of themselves. People watched TV or drank too much until they died, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't want to be that statistic. I don't want to be that happen. So I try to take care of myself. I think you asked earlier the turning point for me. The turning point, I think, unequivocally, one was turning 50 and becoming more aware about it and making some small efforts to turn things around, but also, you know, the fire that we had, you know, when the restaurant was shut for a while.
Yeah.
The fire was a, you know, it was a life-changing experience, both personally and professionally. I think opening back up, I think the restaurant became better than it ever was.
In what way?
I think we came back with more focus. I talked, you know, the time that we were closed, we had an opportunity to professionally to reevaluate every bit of the guest experience. We had the managers all together, and every day that's what we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in supervising the reopening of the restaurant, the rebuild, we visited every facet. We pretended we were guests, walking up the pathway to the restaurant, how they were greeted. Was there direct eye contact? Is the smile genuine? What does the coffee taste like? How do we want to present the check? You know, every little aspect we talked about, and we debated it. And I think we came back, we were hungry. I felt like that we had something to prove. And it was also a big change personally. Many things that were very, very positive, many things that were very, very dark. Looking in, you know, lifestyle, you know, relationships, how I work with people, how I interact with people. And I had a determination not only for the restaurant to be even better than it was, but for me to, I don't want to say be a better person, but to be more in a better sense of being able to do my job the best of my ability. And a key to that was taking better care of myself.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the things you just said about yourself, was that simply a byproduct of having the sort of downtime, for lack of a better word,
that
a chef is rarely accorded because the restaurant wasn't opening every night? Was it a function of that?
There's a little bit more than that. It's not difficult to talk about it, but I made the mistake of what I think now is a mistake in retrospect, in that the restaurant was me. The restaurant was my life.
Yeah.
You know, it meant everything to me, to the detriment of everything else, mm-hmm. to the detriment of relationships and health and that sort of thing. So when the restaurant burned down, I feel that a part of me burned down as well. And the restaurant was rebuilt and I had to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a period there where I kind of disappeared for a while. I was trying to take care of myself, and it wasn't pleasant. But what happened was I had an opportunity to read books. I had a chance to see, sunsets. I had a chance to surf, at the low tide in the afternoons, which I never have a chance to do. I cooked myself dinner every night, which was, I was making omelets and eating cheese, and I was making tomato salads and just very, very simple food. But what happened was I reconnected with food.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for my hand and I was only caring for one other person. I was caring for myself.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big part of coming back around too. It's in the past.
Yeah.
I think the fire and everything that transpired with the fire, it was a blessing in disguise in a certain way, in spite of the pain of the staff. And,
yeah, of course.
The detriment that happened.
And the shock of the event.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Well, thanks for sharing all that.
Yeah.
When you talk about the restaurant piece of it, it's so funny. Every once in a while, something will happen, and the only way to talk about it is in a way that sounds cliched, but I think is probably true. Like, when you talk about the restaurant and the second chance, or the second, it does remind me of people, who, they have a cardiac event, they survive it, and they take a fresh look at their life, and it seems to me like that's what the restaurant went through, the way you describe it. Like, it was a chance to you had a restaurant that had a lot of acclaim already. It probably could have gone a long time without reevaluating anything and nobody would have minded, but you had this opportunity to look at it with fresh eyes.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. And myself.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I was trying not to
dwell
on
the
private
fine.
Part anymore. But so we're having said all this and having been through that phase and arrived at this anniversary, as you look forward to the next phase of the restaurant, how do you think about it at this point? Do you feel like you're sort of at a point of stability now? Do you feel like a restaurant is something that is always evolving? How do you sort of think about Manresa at this milestone?
Yeah, I think Manresa right now, I'm more proud of it now than I've ever been. I think the guest experience is the best we've ever been. I'm very proud of everything that we offer. I think after all these years, I think the food that we offer is excellent quality. I think it tastes great. I think it's thought-provoking. I think we continue to lead to a certain extent. I mean, we're certainly not vanguardist, but
yeah.
I think we're relevant and contemporary,
mm-hmm.
and I'm fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
The restaurant is bigger than me. I would like Manresa to continue. I don't want to work until I die in a kitchen. I want to find some time, for myself. The last quarter of my life. I it could be food related, but I don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to involve, you know, the 75-hour, 80-hour work week.
Are you spiritual about this kind of thing? In other words, do you feel like at some point it will reveal itself to you and you'll
very much
recognize
so.
It if, and if, that'll be, that'll
that
be
is,
that?
If that is spirituality, then I am, yes.
To me, that's spirituality.
Yes, then I agree with you. I mean, you know, in reevaluating things, you know, I thought about, you know, you have your my first third of my life. I was very, very lucky. I realized what I wanted to do at a very early age. I wanted to cook. I wanted to be a cook.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to be a chef.
Yeah.
And those times of my life, you know, growing up and reading books and learning to cook and working, and I just remember not knowing anything, and every progressive state, and working in Louisiana, then moving to New York, and then, you know, starving in Europe, working at these places, you know, and I realized that those were the happiest times of my life. Mm. And there were times where I had no money, you know, worked really, really hard. We played really, really mm-hmm. hard. And, you know, life was grand, you know, everything was a new experience. And then this second third of my life is, you know, for lack of a better term, let's call it the brand. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden I have responsibilities. I open up I go from being a sous chef to a head chef to having my first restaurant to having my second restaurant. And all of a sudden, boom, I got 40 employees. And then I have responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities is keeping the restaurant open and paying bills and paying staff and paying vendors and trying to improve the restaurant and not lose sight of the vision. And that's the professional part of my life. And, you know, I build up a sense of security mm-hmm. on different fronts.
Mm-hmm.
I create a legacy and I create a brand and I'm happy and it's my working part of my life. But and Andrew, you have this last third or last quarter of your life. And is that going to be an unthinking continuation right. of what you did for that second third of your life? Or do you want to do something else?
Yeah.
So you start to think about, you know, the first thing I did is I revisited the first third.
Mm-hmm.
And coming to the realization that it was the happiest time of my life.
Yeah.
And what made it so? So, you know, I make lists and I think about things and I cross things off lists. Mm-hmm. And slowly a plan has come together about eventually what I would like to do to spend, you know, the last part of my life.
Yeah.
And it may involve a restaurant, it may not,
yeah.
and I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing I don't want to do is to continue in an unthinking, unplanned continuation of this second third.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer yet. I don't have an answer. I hope the answer involves a sailboat, you know,
there you go.
And an island so or a beach.
Those are a few
something.
Things that haven't been crossed off the list.
Yeah, read a book. You know, it's like you know, a tomato salad and a sunset
yeah.
and a swim in the ocean.
Don't need much more.
Yeah, I'm a simple lad.
Well, I hope the picture continues to materialize for you.
That's great. You know, don't get me wrong. I'm happy as I've ever been.
Yeah,
certainly
you seem
professionally.
Great. Yeah, you seem great.
And I like the people I work with.
Yeah.
I like our guests. I like where I'm at right
yeah.
now. You know, the fire also allowed me to not, I don't want to say not care, but I don't sweat the little things. I don't mm-hmm. sweat the things I can't control.
Yeah.
What other restaurants and other chefs do, it's become irrelevant to me.
Yeah, you know? It's amazing. We don't need to get into it. I went through a life-changing event 7 years ago, and it's the way I talked about it after. I was someone who could sweat the littlest thing, get so preoccupied with nothing, and it just went away.
Yeah,
it
just amazing,
went away.
Amazing how you feel
yeah.
when you get rid of that.
Yeah. David, we don't know each other that well, but I love sitting and talking with you. I'm flattered you made time to sit with
no, it's
me for
my
an
pleasure.
Hour while you were here.
It's my pleasure. I mean, you know, I like talking to you. I like talking about your last book project. I thought it was really fantastic. It's great talking to you because you don't ask me what my favorite kitchen tool is or what my favorite ingredient is to work with. It's
like, never.
That's half the battle.
Never. That will never
that's
happen.
Half the battle.
All right. On that note, thanks so much. Great to see you.
Of course, Andrew. We'll see you in California.
All right, thanks, Chef. Bye.
And that's our show. A huge thank you to David Kinch for making time for that interview during a very short trip to New York City. We really appreciated it. David, it was great to see you. Thanks for joining us. And as always, if you'd like to follow the show, we are on Twitter and Instagram, and also actually at Facebook, which I usually forget to mention. And at all three, you can look us up at Chef Podcast. That is at Chef Podcast. And you can follow me personally on Twitter and Instagram at Toqueland Andrew, TOQUELAND Andrew. That's Twitter and Instagram. And you can subscribe to the show, as always, on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you might subscribe to your podcasts. As always, thanks to our engineer, David Tatasciore, for putting this thing together. And we'll see you back next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Thanks for listening.